but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. Now, built by High Caliber Millwrights, in for John Canzano, here's Spencer McLaughlin with the Bald-Faced Truth.
Welcome in, everybody, to the start of our number two, jam-packed as always on a Tuesday. I'm Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. We've got some pungent audio to get to. We'll talk college hoops. We'll talk college quarterbacks in the NFL. Where do Caleb Williams, Michael Penix, Bo Nix all fit? How do they fit into the NFL? All that coming up here on this hour. But let's start with some pungent audio, shall we?
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio,
presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
So, for all the wrong reasons, if you're a Dodgers fan, Shohei Ohtani has been making headlines as of late. And everyone is, I'm sure, formulating their own opinion before we know everything. Will we ever know everything? Probably not. This is Major League Baseball we're dealing with. The Houston Astros were probably the biggest cheating scandal in the sport since the Black Sox back in the early 20th century. I don't know if Al Capone was even alive. He was. But anyway, you get my point. We didn't find out anything and everything. Well, we found out some things, but perhaps not everything. So consider me a skeptic that with the biggest star, one of the biggest stars in the world for sports, that we're going to find out every single detail or really know that the MLB is going to get behind this sort of stuff. But Dan Patrick, who is someone I'm sure we're all familiar with at this point in time, sounded off in the Shohei Ohtani situation. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, it's tricky because, I mean, he sounded like he had been taken advantage of, that right. He was innocent, that he didn't know what was going on. It's just, it's really rare when we have some kind of sports crime or somebody related to a crime who is involved in sports. I mean, Manti Te'o is the one where everybody got that wrong because we kept thinking, how could you be duped like that? Well, he was duped like that. But it's really rare when somebody says, hey, I had nothing to do with this. Lance Armstrong, he was America's hero. I had nothing to do with that. Mark McGwire, America's hero. Nothing to do with. It's just rare when it happens. But it does happen, and you still have to go into this going, I need to hear both sides. And that's the troubling part for me.
I think what Patrick says there at the end is a really important point to underscore, because when you have the mass media age, it's so easy to get down an informational rabbit hole. There was a thread going around Twitter of, you know, Shohei Ohtani, look at these games, look at what his props were, look at everything, like guys, just hold on for a moment. Just try to let something play out. I'm not saying I have tons of faith in Major League Baseball, but you got to at least give him a chance because, well, you don't really have any other option at this point. But if you've already formed your own conclusion about what took place with Shohei Ohtani and his translator, then good for you. But for those who are unaware, allow me to briefly bring you up to speed. $4.5 million vanished from Shohei Ohtani's bank account, and there have been accusations and allegations about whether his translator stole the money. Was Shohei Ohtani gambling through the translator? Was he betting here? Of course, that's not allowed, and everything of the sorts. Judah, you know what my favorite my favorite mocking take on this has been somewhat, I don't even know who it was. It might have been a random person tweeted out. You know, the situation you find yourself in covering the story on ESPN, rhetorically, of course, would sound something like this. Let's go to our Baseball Insider brought to you by FanDuel and get to our ESPN bet next segment. John, how did this happen?
Yeah, you know, the hypocrisy with that is pretty palpable. I don't know, man. I think about it as well. Like, you know, the ESPN bet stuff's everywhere. They've got the spreads on the bottom ticker with every story, you know. And yet you got Reese Davis making jokes on, you know, college game day.
Well, Reese Davis was taken out of context there. That clip, and this is why you should only go to the Twitter for jokes. Twitter's great for jokes. Like, during a March Madness basketball game, there's nothing I'd rather do than sit there in silence for the most part and just read the jokes that fly around Twitter, because they're laugh out loud hilarious. But that clip was going around to Reese Davis of, oh, he's saying it's a risk-free investment. That's what he's saying about sports gambling. Like, no, he wasn't, everybody. Let's calm down on that, because that clip was, as many things are on social media, taken completely out of context, because he was saying that in relation to, well, you know, this is something that I feel very confident in is going to happen. And then he makes a joke. Like, that's pretty commonplace sports broadcasting talk there. But it, of course, fed the perception, which is what I believe Judah was getting at. It feeds the perception of, you don't care whether or not there are ethical concerns, whether you're in the right, you're in the wrong, or anything like that.
Right. And that just kind of underscores where we are with sports betting, you know, commentary. And it's making its way into the mainstream media, quote unquote. Guys like Reese Davis are comfortable making jokes about it, which I agree. You know, I didn't have any problem with it, but it shows where we are with the coverage. ESPN's one of these networks deeply in bed with the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NBA. There are inevitably going to be some kind of gray lines getting crossed with some of their coverage. And but at the same time, if you're a player in the NBA, like that Raptors player they're looking into, or Shohei in this case, who's been called into question, you've got to understand that even though there's, you know, some gray lines in sports these days, if you're a player, you can't bet. You just can't do it. Like, just,
yeah, and you've got this situation. You've got this situation with the guy in the NBA. You know, and the sketchy action that was taking place with regards to his props, and he, you know, got injured on games where there was a lot of money pouring in on him to go under this prop stat or anything of the sorts. And I think the kind of old school talking heads or fans, anybody out there who object to sports betting and think that gambling is bad and wrong and that it presents a moral quandary and anything of the sorts, those people are Kermit the Frog with an iced tea right now, because they're just sitting back and going, I tried to tell you. I don't know where these people are. Maybe I'm making up, you know, some Mel Gibson character in my head, but I think that there are plenty of people who are saying, look, you couldn't see this coming, that you couldn't predict this happening. And look, before I get back to the Shohei thing in a sec, just broadly speaking, with regards to sports gambling, I've got no problem with it as long as it is not pertaining to the sport that you are directly a part of or that you directly cover. For example, some of you may or may not know, I'm the play-by-play voice for Southern Utah University. So as a result, as someone who is paid by the university, I cannot gamble on any college athletics because I'm involved in that space. Thus, of course, I do not. But I am also not allowed, as someone who's affiliated with that university, of gambling on professional sports. That is not allowed. And to me, Judah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I personally do not have a problem with that. If I wanted to go and, you know, place $10 on the Seahawks +3.5 some game, I have no ties. I have no affiliation. But anyone who is affiliated with the sport or with the league, that's where you can introduce objectionably or morally objectionable territory, I think is where you get into. And that may eventually change one day. But if you're in the sport, PSA for any professional athletes listening out there, if you're in the sport, you shouldn't be able to bet on it. I think we all agree with that. It creates too many, there's too much money involved, and you know, the public is betting on these games and everything like that. That is no good. But if a Major League Baseball player wants to put, you know, $1,000 on the Packers -2.5 or whatever it is, I don't think that represents a problem in it of itself.
Right. And I think they're allowed to, in that regard. But man, lines can blur real quick with this stuff. And, you know, these are athletes that are making millions of dollars. So when we're talking discretionary income, you know, they want it, especially in the off season, they want to get that little high. They want to get that jolt, that rush of excitement when they're not playing the sport that they love. And, you know, they're going to put down some G's on some other sports. But, man, you got to be so careful with this stuff. I don't envy their position per se, because it is an enjoyable thing to do responsibly. But at the same time, they're already making so much money. Like, let's not be foolish with throwing around on the sport that you're playing.
Well, I don't think any of these reports are, you know, amounts of money where guys are spending their life savings or anything like that. I think, like you said, they just like the enjoyment, the entertainment factor. But I'll close with this on the Shohei Ohtani to bring it back, because that's, of course, the big gambling story. Is if this were pertaining to a coach, and, you know, I think about stories like the Art Briles situation at Baylor, Rick Pitino at Louisville, you're either coaching it or allowing it to happen. That's how it feels to me with Ohtani. I'm not saying I know or that I think, because I don't know anything that happened there. I don't have firsthand knowledge. I know as much as all of you listening right now. I don't think that he, you know, necessarily 100% guaranteed, oh yeah, he was gambling, he's in the wrong, he's rigging all the, and everything like that. But even for Shohei Ohtani, $4.5 million, he hasn't gotten that. Remember, the Dodgers aren't going to pay him until I'm in my 50s. So he's made plenty of money with the Angels. That's to be sure. But $4.5 million, if it was a little bit over time, maybe he knew absolutely nothing. But I think they've fumbled this from a PR standpoint, because they've gone back and forth on, no, he paid off a gambling debt for his friend, which, you know, might at some level kind of be admirable, to, no, he didn't know anything about this at all. It's like, well, wait, I thought you said he was paying the software. So I think they've kind of dropped the ball on that. But let's move along with the punch it audio. What else you got out there, Judah?
Man, we got Deion Sanders audio.
Gosh, everybody loves Coach Prime Talk, don't they?
He is compelling. Of course,
in many ways, yes. For better or worse, shall we say, he is compelling as a content creator. Go ahead and run that one.
Well, you know,
what do you predict Shador and Travis going in the draft?
Top four.
Ooh, that's beautiful.
Anywhere from 1 through 4. One of them is going to be one.
Mm. That's what I'm talking about.
One of them is going to be
speaking into existence.
And the latter one would not go behind four. Mm. Now, all this is subjective, because I know where I kind of want them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget Shallow, okay? Mm-hmm. But I know where I want them to go. So there's certain cities that ain't gonna happen.
Okay, you on point.
It's gonna be an Eli.
All right, so a couple of things. First of all, I love the host there giving these audible reactions that sound like he's just bitten into a really good piece of pizza, Dave Portnoy style, just biting a just all about the energy, which, like, okay.
7 out of 10. One bite.
I think it's
One
like a, I think it's like a 7-2, Steven.
Seven
it's like a, or Judah, it's like a 7-2. Okay, so
no flop.
Right undercarriage. Great undercarriage. But I think that for Deion Sanders, a lot of people, I think, are going to hear that clip and think, oh my gosh, he's being so ridiculous. He's being over the top. And it probably is a little bit. But just ask yourself this question. If you're a college football fan, whether it's Oregon, Oregon State, Washington State, whatever, whoever your team is out there, don't you want your coach to talk up your players? That's what I'd want from my coach, is for him to believe that he has guys capable of going in that position. And, you know, other coaches, take Urban Meyer, for example. He was very honest about the late Dwayne Haskins when he was coming out of college, that, you know, he's got a lot of potential, but he also needs a decent amount of work. And I think that was, of, you know, an honest and probably fair comment to make at the time. But is Urban Meyer somebody who people liked in NFL circles, or who's known for being a great locker room guy? Not exactly. Like, I want my coach to have an honest but also unwavering belief in the players that he has and the coaches that he has. And also, Shedeur Sanders and Travis Hunter, very talented players. I think Hunter is probably a defensive back in the NFL, not a receiver. You know, I think he's an Adoree Jackson kind of guy, maybe a little more talented, but certainly can improve this year with the Buffs. Shedeur Sanders got a lot of NFL traits. Size, mobility, arm, lot of NFL traits there. So I think that clip overall is fine until the end. And this is... This drives me a little bit insane. The players, the coaches, the parents who say, yeah, we're not going to go to that organization. Well, then maybe you should just stay in college where you can choose whatever you want. Because in the NFL, and this is why the transfer portal just so ill prepares players for what they'll experience in the NFL. In the transfer portal, you are a constant free agent. You can leave at any time. You can always go play. And in the NFL, you have to be able to be a team player. You have to be willing to go and put yourself in as a part of a structure, of an environment. You are not the environment itself. I don't care for that. I like Deion Sanders having a belief that his players can be very good. I do not care for this notion of, well, they shouldn't go to that organization. Like, it's the NFL version of realignment, because what it's doing is saying, no, only the biggest and best should have anything, and everybody else should just be left out to suffer through a slow, painful death. That's what it is. We're gonna kick you to the curb, throw you to the waste. Sorry, you're not good enough. What if the Bengals are, in many respects, a poorly run organization? What if Joe Burrow had done that with Cincinnati? You're always one player away. And I don't appreciate the self-centered nature of, you're not good enough for me. I'm better than you. You haven't taken a snap in the NFL, and you've got the arrogance to believe that you're too good for that organization. If you're so confident in your own beliefs, first of all, when they offer you an extension on your rookie contract, you don't have to sign it if you think someone else will give you a better deal. And second of all, if you're as good as you clearly think you are, that you should be able to, and I'm talking Shedeur Sanders in this particular clip, Caleb Williams, they've had these conversations before, going all the way back, of course, to Eli Manning, what he did to the Chargers and everything like that. If you are actually such a gift to the game of football, you're going to be the guy to go and turn that around. But nobody thinks that way, or at least not enough. I won't say nobody thinks that way. But Judah, I do not care for that mindset, because football is the greatest team sport, even more so than soccer. I know there are 11 guys on the field in soccer, but it takes three guys to score a goal. Play it in the middle, play it back, send it into the box, head it past the keeper. One, two, three. Bingo, bango, bongo. you're done. Football, you need 11 guys. Okay, you need 8 guys doing their job to complete a 5-yard slam. That's a lot. That's just a lot more. It's the ultimate team game, and I don't like how the individuality can trump that sometimes.
Yeah. It's just funny, you know, Elway did it to an extent. Eli did it. They both won Super Bowls, right? I mean, Elway went back-to-back. Eli won a couple. It's just funny how those careers play out in retrospect. And, like, everybody loves Eli Manning. You know, he's such a lovable guy. You know,
That's because most people, myself included, didn't grow up with the drama of what he was doing coming out of the draft.
Right, right. But to be honest, you know, that's royalty. That's family football royalty as well. I think these are outliers, exceptions that prove the rule that you're referencing, rather than, you know, having guys like Caleb Williams say, you know what, I'm thinking about not going to the Chicago Bears number one overall. And that ship has since sailed. It seems like he's fully, you know, okay with going to Chicago. But even just floating it out there was a little bit like, really, man, you're going to play that card? And yeah, I didn't really buy it for a second. But at a certain point, you know, the entitlement is certainly going to another level at a place that it hasn't before. The NFL is a business, man. It's a capital B business. That's what it is. It's not... You get to pick your destination like you pick in a college, you know, the way that the college football is these days. So I'm with you. You know, no matter how talented you are, at the end of the day, you are going to be somebody's draft pick, and you got to play for them. You're going to be making millions of dollars anyway.
Yeah. And I think that if it's such a horrible situation, then guess what? It's not going to last your entire career. It just isn't. Your rookie contract will eventually come up. Judah agrees with me. That's why he's sitting in the chair over there, and I accept him being back with me here on the show. We've still got plenty more to get to, more quarterback talk. What are the best landing spots for Bo Nix and Michael Penix, and is it the same spot? Coming up next right here, Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
Hey, it's John Canzano.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. Before we get to some quarterback chatter, I heard a clip from Ian Eagle, great play-by-play announcer, TV guy for the Brooklyn Nets, has covered March Madness for a long time as well. And this caught my ear. My ear, not my eye and ear mixed together, which was the word I said previously, but caught my ear as a play-by-play announcer myself. And, you know, Jim Nance has called his last Final Four. He's still doing the Masters in the NFL, but Ian Eagle was the choice to replace him, made by Turner, who's got the broadcasting rights to the men's tournament. Here's Ian Eagle talking about his approach to calling the Final Four and the national championship this year.
I've done so many games. It's not like this is a new role in terms of what my responsibilities are. I've done the tournament for 26 years, and I do probably about 100 basketball games a year between college, NBA, local, national. So I just remind myself, do what you do. You're not going to change what you do, how you approach it, how you prepare, the energy that you bring to the event. Of course, the stage is a bit larger and it's vast, and I'll be aware of it. I'll be aware of my surroundings, but I would be really surprised if I change the way that I do the game just because it's the Final Four. If anything, I might end up doing a little bit less because you have really nice pictures and sound, and I think some of the ambient noise is okay. So if I pull back a little bit, that might be more of a conscious decision than to do more than I would normally do.
Yeah, Ian Eagle, one of the best in the business. This reminded me of Tiger Woods. Now, why? Because Tiger Woods, a couple of years ago, was playing in the PNC Championship with his son Charlie, and he was asked a question, and this applies to anybody out there who's, you know, got anything to perform or any big stage or a big moment coming up in your career, personal life, whatever. Tiger was asked about Charlie Woods and, you know, what do you tell him about playing on TV or playing in front of a gallery? And Tiger said, well, I, you know, talked to him about how whether one person is watching or a million, the same exact thing is required to hit that shot. Whatever it is, whether you're hitting a bunker shot, approach shot, hitting the ball off the tee, the same exact fundamentals apply. You just got more people watching. So I like that from Ian Eagle in the broadcasting space, and I thought it was worth sharing. But we were talking about the quarterbacks, and we'll come back to Caleb Williams. But Michael Penix and Bo Nix just had outstanding Heisman finalist seasons with Washington and Oregon this past year. And Judah and Steven, I want to rope you guys in on this as well, because when I think about where the best fits are, I'll start with Bo Nix. I just can't shake the Denver Broncos as the most ideal spot. I think the scheme that Sean Payton runs fits with what Bo Nix did at Oregon, plays to his strengths. And you're also going to a situation where Bo Nix doesn't have to carry the team. I don't think he or Penix are those sorts of guys. I think Caleb Williams and Drake May are. And, you know, we can get to Penix in a moment, but I cannot shake that in the NFL draft, Bo Nix to the Denver Broncos is a borderline perfect fit for where he can have the best pro career. What do you guys make of that?
Boy, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I just look at Sean Payton and the Broncos are at 12. And whenever I think of Sean Payton, middle of the first round and possible quarterbacks, I think of the story he tells about Patrick Mahomes and the Saints and how they really wanted Mahomes. And it was a dead heat between him and Marshawn Lattimore. They were deciding between. And lo and behold, Andy Reid, you know, and the Chiefs trade right past the Saints and end up taking Mahomes at 10 right in front of the Saints. And I feel like, you know, that changes the history of the league. You know, if you can imagine Mahomes and Sean Payton Saints offense succeeding Drew Brees, like, holy cow, indoors? Are you kidding me right now? Like, think of what he's already done in Arrowhead and six straight AFC title appearances and Super Bowls, etc. So I definitely think the Broncos are a candidate to take a quarterback. I almost think, though, they got to trade up to do it, unless, to your point, unless they are all in on Bo Nix and are comfortable sticking and picking and taking Bo at 12. Because even though as we're getting crazy, you know, drunk on quarterbacks right now, there's no way Bo Nix goes higher than 12th overall in the draft. I mean, there's no way. I mean, I could be having egg on my face. There's no way that Bo Nix goes higher than 12.
I can't see him, especially not with the latest buzz that J.J. McCarthy could go second, which is, you know, that gives me Will Levis vibes. Totally. I mean, he was, you know, flying up because of his physical traits to go second overall in the draft. He fell to the third round. I don't even know if he'll ever start for the Titans. But, Steven, Bo Nix to the Broncos, you like that fit?
It's a good fit. I mean, obviously the Broncos need a quarterback, and that's kind of what they've needed the last couple of years. And with the Sean Payton offense, it is more of a point guard role, right? Like, that's what he kind of played at Oregon, was just, you know, dunk it down low, let his players make some plays. And I think that's what Denver wants to do as well. I do question, though, Bo Nix's ability to take a team to the next level. Like, he's getting a lot of credit because of Brock Purdy's success in the NFL. You know, Brock Purdy, not the most skilled quarterback in the NFL, sneaky athletic. Bo Nix, same type of you know, build, same type of sneaky athleticism. I think Brock Purdy's doing a lot for Bo Nix's stock here, because the fact that he's being considered at number 12 is so high in my mind. Like, that's just wild to me that Bo Nix would be considered the number 12 pick in the draft. Going into the season, it wasn't even thought that he would be a first-round pick, and now he's going to be top half of the first round. Like, I understand we're quarterback crazy. We need every team needs a quarterback. But, man, if you're going to, you know, go up to number 12 and you're going to stay there if you're the Broncos and take Bo Nix, you really have to love that guy. I just don't know what he's going to do to change your whole NFL team. Like, you're going to have a lot of pieces around him. He's not going to be the focal point. It's going to have to be all the skill positions around him that are really helping him. But with that said, I think Bo Nix can be successful. He's very smart, very hardworking. But, I mean, is he a special caliber quarterback in the NFL? I'm not sure I see that.
Yeah, I think for Nix, the reason the Payton marriage is just so great in my mind is that Drew Brees was always about efficiency, execution, and Sean Payton wants the ball to go here, so it goes here. That's why Sean Payton and Russell Wilson didn't work. Russell Wilson likes to ad-lib, likes to extend the play, and he can't always see over the line where the ball's designed to go. Whereas Bo Nix doesn't have that problem. And when I think about what he did with Will Stein this past season, their deadliest quality was the speed with which it came out of Bo Nix's hands, the ball that is, because he knew, based on the play call and the coverage, where it was supposed to go. And he delivers it on time, on target, and you don't even give the defensive line a chance there. Now, Penix is more interesting because Penix has got the injury history, and he and both Nix are, and Bo Nix are both very old. And, you know, I think that Penix's arm talent is just immense. His accuracy down the field is, gosh, unlike anything, frankly, I think I have seen recently since Joe Burrow. I think that is kind of the high end for Michael Penix, but I don't know if the mobility is there the way that it is for Joe Burrow. But I like Penix to the Vikings. Now, I think either of these guys could work on the other's top option, as I am deeming them here on the show. But there's a great joke out there. I'll filter it to make it G-rated here so they don't get sued since we're on the radio and such, in which Kirk Cousins over the years would have some passes that kind of looked like, screw it, Justin Jefferson's down there somewhere. And then Justin Jefferson would just go make the play. But Justin Jefferson, Jordan Addison, those guys are deep threats. And I think you could have Penix with Devontae Adams, but he's certainly a little older. Jefferson and Addison are in the primes of their careers. And Penix's deep ball accuracy is as good as anybody coming out of college since Joe Burrow. And I think when you have two vertical threats like that, who can make 50-50 catches, who can push it down the field, that's what Penix does best. And then you have an offensive coach in Kevin O'Connell who was just dealing with a quarterback that didn't have a lot of mobility. And heck, Penix might have a little bit more than Kirk Cousins, who I might be able to beat in a 40-yard dash. So I'm just kidding. My nickname in high school basketball from one of my coaches, true story, he nicknamed me Cement Foot because he said when I ran, it looked like I was running in wet cement. So that aside, Penix to the Vikings feels absolutely perfect with those receivers and that coach in that system.
Man, they need a QB as well. You know, if he goes there, is he supposed to start right away? You know, I don't know what other quarterback pathways exist. I think he can, because to your point, you know, he's older and he's got the experience, he's got the refinement, and I think most importantly, he's got the coach, the play caller. Tremendous mm-hmm. amount of respect for Kevin O'Connell. And secondarily, yeah, you got Justin Jefferson, who's obviously really, really good. Their old line is solid. They're returning a lot of their same guys.
You're not buying into Sam Darnold being the starting quarterback?
Thanks for reminding me. I'm glass half full with Sammy D.
Still only 26 years old, by the way. Darnold.
Well, how old is Penix? 32?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, they'll have an old QB room, but
here's where I'd come down on Sam Darnold. We've seen it at this point. Like we know. Either of you guys play a lot of golf?
Yeah, I love golf. I haven't played. Okay, I haven't had the honor of playing with you yet, but we'll make that happen.
No, not yet, but we'll make it happen eventually for sure. Probably this summer. But I think that when you're learning to play golf, you come to understand that you have strengths and weaknesses, and what is, you know, a weakness for one person can be an absolute strength for another. For example, I'm a horrendous putter, but I always have been. And I've always been very good off the tee. I just know that about myself because I've got enough data to where I can know, okay, I'm never going to be an elite putter. Doesn't mean I'm not going to keep working to try to get better. I've got enough data on Sam Darnold. I know what he is. That's not someone who's taking your franchise to the next level. He could be a capable backup, fill in every now and then if Penix gets dinged up. I think that's fine. But I've seen enough of Sam Darnold to know that's not an answer for a franchise if you're being serious at quarterback.
The counterpoints, and I'm not sure how strong arguments they are the Baker Mayfield, Geno Smith arguments of hey, they failed in one spot.
Maybe. Two guys who went and had some success and are never going to sniff a Super Bowl as a starting quarterback. Congratulations.
But with Darnold, he now has had the tutelage of Kyle Shanahan. Now he's going to Kevin O'Connell, who was another good quarterback, quarterback coach, offensive coach. You look at who they had before. He's going with the Jets. He's going with the Panthers. Of course, he's not going to be successful there. You look at the same thing with Baker Mayfield. He's with the Browns before they had their guys. They had that one.
Baker Mayfield or Kevin Stefanski. Kevin Stefanski is a very good coach.
He also had the other coach that got fired. Hugh Jackson.
Oh, Hugh Jackson.
No, the one after that, too. But that's the thing is now maybe he's learned more. He's still in 26 years old. Penix is going to be 24 when the season starts. Like, it's not as if Darnold has lost his ability. He was a top three pick for a reason. Like,
and I wonder how many people would have said that about Jared Goff as well when he just got cast aside, you know, in the Stafford deal.
I think you can get new life at a second stop. But once you're on your third or fourth team and multiple organizations have said thanks but no thanks, I think I've seen enough there. I mean, if he's, you know, as good as you guys think he could be, Sam Darnold, that is, that to me only makes Penix even more of a perfect fit, because then he's going to go and he's going to get pushed by somebody. He's not going to be able to just rest on, I'm a top pick. And look, I've met Penix before. He's a very, very nice, humble guy. But I don't think getting pushed in a competitive environment like that is the worst thing in the world. I think bringing him in and seeing what you have right away, I don't hate that for the Vikings at all. I think Addison, Jefferson, Penix, I think that's a pretty high-level offense.
For the record, I'm not a big Sam Darnold guy. I'm playing devil's advocate here. But I agree. Michael Penix throwing to those guys would work, because the thing that Penix does is throw the ball downfield, right? And totally. Justin Jefferson, Jordan Addison can get behind the defense and get behind him. So I think you're right in the fact that they do need a quarterback. Is it Michael Penix? I don't know if that's the answer, but Penix has a certain skill set in the NFL that you need a certain skill position for, just like Bo Nix does, right? Like with the Broncos, I think he fits. He can spread it around. Penix, same thing. You need some speedsters out there. Jefferson and Addison can do that for him. So that would be a good fit for Michael Penix.
Well, and the last thing I would add on the Vikings standpoint is they just made a trade last week to get out of the second round and get two first-round picks, right? So they're picking at 11. They're also picking at 23. Is Penix at 23? Little rich for my blood, but if you want him in the second round, the Vikings currently don't have a second round pick. They feel like a team poised, similar to what I think Sean Payton, muscle up and trade up even further in the first round to get a McCarthy or your QB du jour. But the Penix fit makes a lot of sense. Do you think it would be at 23 in the first round?
Two first rounders, you could move up. That's at least a starting point to have a conversation about moving up to the top five in the draft and get one of the quarterbacks if you don't think they'll be there. But on the Vikings, I you probably need a defensive piece, and I'd take Penix with one of those picks. Before we take a quick break, just a thought on Caleb Williams. I'm going to make a prediction here. He is going to have to endure at least two different coaching staffs in Chicago. I don't think there is a huge difference between Caleb Williams and Justin Fields. I've always been a huge fan of Fields. I think Williams is better in a number of ways, but I don't think the Bears are going to magically fix themselves. I think Williams goes number one overall. I think he should. I think he's an awesome prospect. And I think when it doesn't go as well as it should this year, the Bears will make a coaching change. And hopefully they, you know, for Caleb Williams' sake, they get somebody in there that is better than Matt Eberflus and Luke Getsy. Because I've seen those two guys with a really physically talented and gifted quarterback before. It didn't go well. Shocking. The Bears did not go well. Take a break. Come back. Dana Altman, remember when he was going to retire? That was hilarious. We'll talk about that coming up next right here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
I challenge you to a dance-off.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. Steven and Judah with me as always. Quick correction from a comment I made before the break. It slipped my mind that Shane Waldron has been hired as the offensive coordinator for the Chicago Bears. And Judah, I know you're a Seahawks fan as well. Can we just take a moment to warn Bears fans that it's not going to be all that impressive?
I don't know. As soon as Caleb Williams lines up with three tight ends in the backfield, two next to him, one behind him, like a full house formation out of shotgun with a bunch of 250 pounders. Look, I don't hate Shaden Waldron. I think the results were a little bit lacking, but I love Geno as well. I'm a Geno guy. But I saw Jackson Smith and Jigba talk about him a little bit, and he wasn't all that enthralled with his play caller his rookie year. So I am pretty fascinated to see how Caleb Williams and Keenan Allen and all the talent that they have in Chicago is orchestrated by one Shane Waldron. That's one of my top storylines for sure for next year.
Yeah, I think that's a good trio there. I mean, Williams, they've got Komet, the tight end, who's good. Running backs are a dime a dozen, but DJ Moore, Keenan Allen's a pretty solid base there. But for those who don't know, Jackson Smith and Jigba essentially did the, you know, if he were getting set up with a friend, well, what's she like? Well, she's got a great personality. It's like, okay, well, that's good. That's good. But there's another factor that I'm thinking about here, because he was asked about Shaden Waldron. You go, well, he's a nice guy.
There's nothing wrong with having a nice personality. Come on now. You know, it's good to have a little personality.
No, of course not.
Right?
Of course not. Nothing wrong with that, of course. So during the course of this year, there was plenty of chatter amongst Oregon basketball fans that Dana Altman should no longer be the head coach, that a change needed to be made. Should they go get Kyle Smith, which is what, of course, Stanford has done. Dana Altman then silenced everybody. The critics of the Oregon men's basketball coach, they've retreated back into their internet corners because there's, well, nothing you can say when he takes the team to a round of 32. So, you know, I was waiting to give a full assessment of where I felt Dana Altman's job security should be until the season came to a close. Turns out it's a good thing I did, because I did not have winning three games in 3 days in the Pac-12 tournament on my bingo card. And then, you know, once they matched up with South Carolina, I thought they'd win that game. They should have beaten Creighton to get to the Sweet 16. But I think what Dana Altman did is remind everybody, yeah, he's still got it. He hasn't lost it. Because you've seen a lot of older coaches, legendary coaches, decide to retire, right? Tom Izzo's still around. Bill Self is still around. John Calipari's still losing to athletic departments whose entire budget's less than his salary. But Jim Boeheim, he retired. Jay Wright, Villanova, two titles in 3 years, that guy, he's gone. Roy Williams, out. Coach K, gone. Well, Dana Altman is still hanging around. It doesn't feel like the game has passed him by, or that he's unwilling to dive into NIL or the transfer portal. And I think that's part of the reason he's going to be able to continue to succeed. Their luck with injuries has been horrific over the last few years. And it really, you know, came to a point this season. Oregon missed more games from rotation players than anybody else in college basketball. It was not particularly close. They still had a 20-win regular season, won the Pac-12 tournament, got to the round of 32. They missed about 50 games over the course of the season or more, if you include the tournaments that they played in, from rotation players. Nobody else in college basketball has more than like 40. 10 games of a dip. And by the way, those are the highly injured teams. What if you weren't a highly injured team? I think Oregon's legitimately just had some bad luck. And, you know, it's frustrating to be sure. Like, this was not a frustrating year by the end of it. But during the regular season, when it looked like Oregon was headed towards the NIT, yeah, it's frustrating for your fan. Of course it is. Because you've seen what this program's capable of being with this guy, Dana Altman, at the helm. And those results were not being generated. They just weren't. And so for Altman to make this run, I think can really invigorate the program. Because look at this season at a glance. If you had a different team, different program, different coach, and I laid out this information, let's say you just hired a young coach. You know, Austin Clonch, for instance, just got hired at UTSA. He was at Alabama as an associate. He was at Nichols down in the Southland Conference before that. If Austin Clonch had the most injured team in college basketball, his guy was in his mid-30s, and he won 20 regular season games and got to the NCAA tournament, what would you feel about him? You'd say, that's an incredible coaching job. That's what this was. Dana Altman just had one of his best coaching jobs ever. And the last couple of years were not up to his standard. Not going to try and argue with you on that one. But the retirement talk, given the situation that he was in, and it's not like, you know, he put his team in that situation. No, they just happened to get hurt. Yeah, big guys can get hurt. Yeah, and Folly Dante's had an injury-riddled career. But Biddle and Dante, both missing all the time they did this year, nobody else is going through that. Mo Diawara did a more than admirable job filling in, but he was never supposed to be a starting center. And for long stretches of the season, he was. And Altman still got Oregon to the fourth seed of a conference that put four teams in the NCAA tournament, started the tournament 6-0, and still has a team alive in the Sweet 16. It wasn't perfect. It never is over the course of a college basketball season. You're not going to get the result you want every time. There are just too many games to be played. It's like baseball a little bit. You can't win them all. But I think Dana Altman sent as clear a message as you possibly can. Not just when he was asked the question about his retirement, I'm not going anywhere unless they want me out. I don't think anybody wants him out now. Because once again, his name is Dana Altman, folks. He aligns Rubik's Cubes. Rubik's Cubes indeed. Hour number three is coming your way next.
If you've been looking...
BFFT. Now, built by High Caliber Millwrights. In for John Canzano, here's Spencer McLaughlin with the Bald-Faced Truth.
It is our number three. Hope your Tuesday is going great, everybody. Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. And we have just hit 5 o'clock Pacific time. And do you all know what that means? I'll tell you. It is time for the 5 at 5, the 5 biggest stories according to Stephen Bond. We'll see if I agree. I might not. I'll have thoughts either way. Let's get to the 5 at 5.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
All right, Spencer, number one story in my mind, Pat Chun. I know you got some takes on this. Pat Chun leaving Washington State to go to the rivals Washington Huskies to be their new AD. Now, it's a 6-year deal for Chun. Of course, Chun was formerly with Ohio State as he was in charge of development and fundraising for the Ohio State Buckeyes. And then he was also the AD at FAU, where he did set records for fundraising for both Ohio State and for Florida Atlantic. And while he's at Washington State as the athletic director, set records there for fundraising as well. So now Chun heading over to the rivals, over to Seattle to be athletic director for the Washington Huskies. Reportedly, his salary will be bumped up to a base salary of $700,000 at Washington. Spencer, what do you think of Pat Chun going to Washington and saying goodbye to Washington State?
Well, I definitely agree that that's story number one. Number two, it's epitomizing everything that's wrong with the wonderful, beautiful world of college athletics. I love them more than I can describe, but so many things are out of whack, out of sync, not taking into account the people that are affected by all of these sorts of moves. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that the lack of structure from the NCAA, who gave power to the conferences, and they took a backseat to college football, and they weren't able to, you know, maintain their influence the way they did on college basketball. And then the conferences kind of yielded power to the television networks. That's what everyone's at the mercy of now. And if that dynamic hadn't taken place, if the Pac-12 never implodes, I don't think Pat Chun is at Washington right now. And to go from one school to another, that's one thing, right? Like Kyle Smith, I don't think is viewed as the level of a boogeyman that Pat Chun is in the eyes of Washington State fans, or at least he shouldn't be, because he goes down to Stanford. He's got a history in the Bay Area. he was at Washington State for a long time, had a very successful tenure there up in Pullman, and he's going to the ACC. And, you know, Stanford, yeah, there's a history with Washington State because of their affiliation in the Pac-12, but there's not anything like what there is between Washington and Washington State. And, you know, it feels wrong. It just feels wrong to say that in 2023, he was hoping down to his last breath that Cam Ward and the Cougs and Jake Dicker could pull it out and they'd make a bowl game and end Washington's perfect season. And now in the following year, he's going to hope that the Huskies blast them by 40 points. That just doesn't feel right.
What does that say about Washington State's program in general in the Pac-12 or Pac-2, I should say, going forward? It seems to me the fact that Scott Barnes has stayed, they got Trent Bray to stay there. Wayne Tinkle, think about wherever he is, but he's still there. It seems like Oregon State is investing more in their athletic program than Washington State is. And I think it's a bad sign for Washington State that all these guys are leaving and they're not really thinking anything of it. I mean, Kyle Smith left right after the tournament.
I think it's the materialization of Washington State's undeserved and unchosen relegation. I don't know that in this environment there's anything that they could have done. They're just being left behind by way of geography and school size and brand and such. I don't think that even if they'd made more investments over the years than they did in their athletics programs, it would have changed the reality on the ground. Stanford would always be a more appealing job for someone like Kyle Smith than Washington State, even if they were in the Pac-12.
Do you think if the Pac-12 stayed together, Kyle Smith still at Stanford?
I think Smith would have taken a bigger job, whether Ohio State had come after him or
Is Pat Chun still the AD at Washington State if the Pac-12 is still there?
I think Pat Chun is still the AD. I don't think Kyle Smith is still the coach. I think Chun is moving because of the ongoing relegation here. So let's get to the second one.
Number two.
Well, Spencer, I wish I would have known this and could have been on board with the Jonte Porter news, as he has been under investigation by the NBA with some betting props. All these issues have to do with those. Now, what happened was during the January 26th game with the Toronto Raptors, Jonte Porter, there was a lot of betting interest on his unders of points, 5.5, rebounds, 4.5, assists, 1.5, and also his three-point prop was at a half of three-pointer per game. Now, in that game, the Raptors forward played 4 minutes before leaving with an re-aggravation of an eye injury. He didn't score. He had 3 rebounds, 1 assist, didn't attempt a 3. So all his betting props went under. DraftKings then stated the next day that the under bets on Porter's 3 was the biggest moneymaker for bettors of any player props. A little weird for a guy that very rarely plays. Then this happened again on March 20th against the Kings. His props were set at 7.5 points, 5.5 rebounds. Porter plays 3 minutes before leaving the game with an illness. DraftKings said the same thing. Number one moneymaker was Jonte Porter under props. Now, Raptors coach Darko Raftovic has said that he never doubts injuries or players' honesty, so he never thought anything of it, but the NBA is investigating Jonte Porter and his involvement in what could be a little prop bet under for a lot of his friends made a lot of money.
Well, before I put on my tinfoil hat, is it fair to wonder whether or not a guy who sparsely plays just wasn't happening to play a lot on the nights where he was going under, or was there a trend statistically that could account for what is taking place in these two particular games that are spaced out? Because it's not as if this was happening every game, because the first game you mentioned was when, back in
January,
and the second one is in March. Well, why was it those particular games? Like, maybe on those particular nights, someone knows something about the matchup in Vegas and knows he's not going to play a lot in this game. He doesn't produce a lot anyway. I see how you can align the dots.
The sketchy part about this, Spencer, is the fact that he was not on any injury report, and then he left the game in the middle of the game with said injuries that apparently he re-aggravated, or he got sick and they didn't know about it. So that's kind of the reason why they're investigating this, is that he just left the game for really no out of nowhere, and these props were out there. So it's one of those things where they just don't really know what's happening. I kind of think maybe he is doing something, but that's just my thought.
And that's certainly the way it looks from a 30,000-foot view, but to say that there are no plausible scenarios where everything was played down the line and they just happen to be profitable days, I don't think that that's something you can rule out. But if it's worthy of an investigation, which it appears to be, then go forward and investigate. I think that's fine. But I think before, you know, like the Shohei Ohtani situation, don't make up your mind about what happened before you know what happened. Don't seek confirmation bias. Just seek to know what took place and trust reliable reporting on the matter.
Number three.
Well, the NFL owners, they have agreed to change the kickoff rule in the NFL. Spencer, we'll no longer see the NFL kickoffs as we've seen them before. The new way is the same way they did in the XFL. If you watch the XFL, I really didn't, so I had to kind of look this up to figure out what exactly it was. But it's going to be the XFL kickoff. Now, what that means is the kickoff will still occur at the 35-yard line, but the coverage team will start at the receiving team's 40-yard line, lined up against the receiving team. Now, if the kickoff is a touchback in the air, the receiving team will start with the ball at the 30-yard line on the touchback. What is happening is the NFL is hoping for more kickoff returns, less injuries, as they won't be getting a full head of speed or full head of steam running down the field on the sprint. They'll just be blocking right away. Kickoff returns last year, they happened at only 21.7% of kickoffs, which was a record low for the NFL. The NFL is trying to bring a little more action back into the game, make the kickoff a normal play once again. I don't know about this. I feel like they should just get rid of kickoffs, but that's just me.
No, I think that this is reminiscent of moving back the extra point. It's something that, you know, over the past years, because of the skill of the players in the league nowadays and the kickers themselves, even though a lot of fans probably think the kickers aren't any good and they miss big and all that sort of stuff. But there are a lot of great kickers out there, especially at the professional ranks. College is where it gets iffy. And then the iffiest is, of course, anyone who steps up to try to kick a ball on college game day, which I swear, Pat McAfee, I love that segment. I swear he seeks out the guy who has played the least amount of any sport ever to try and kick those field goals for the most part. But bring it back to the kickoff. I liken it to the extra point because the extra point was too easy. Well, now it's too easy to get a touchback. And so if you remove at least somewhat an incentive for a touchback, you create an exciting play. And yeah, there are a decent amount of injuries there. And I don't think that you are altering the game in a significant way by making that move to reduce injuries. Whereas the hip drop tackle, I think, is just patently absurd. I think it is utterly ridiculous, and you're putting way too much of an onus on a defensive player to say you can't drop your hips. And drop your hips below what level? I think the enforcement of that, like roughing the passer, is going to be a mess. It is going to frustrate fans. It is going to be really annoying and irritating to watch. You're going to have the officials more involved in plays because this is going to take a while to get out. And the officials are already too involved in the NFL and college football. I want them less involved, not more. But I think this kickoff move creates an exciting play that'll occur more often, and it does it safely. I think that's a win-win.
The swivel tackle is going to make me mad on a 4th-and-25 in the playoffs, and Patrick Mahomes scrambles for 15, and then all of a sudden it's a swivel hip tackle, and they get a first down, and I'm betting on the other team.
What's the punishment for it? Is it a personal foul?
It's a 15 yards on automatic first down.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and it's all subjective. You know that's going to happen for the Stars, and Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce when I bet against the Chiefs and lose every time. That's just not.
Number four.
15. That was me just reminiscing on the playoffs this past season, me losing every time. Okay, number four. So the NFL, they're going to hold two games on Christmas, Spencer, again. I remember last year they had three games on Christmas, which had historic ratings. But this year, Christmas is on a Wednesday. But they're going to have a doubleheader anyways. Hans Schroeder, NFL Executive Vice President of Media Distribution, announced that today at the annual league meeting. He said, for what we've seen the last couple of years, is some unprecedented growth, and not just on Christmas, on Thanksgiving too. The last couple of years, we've had the highest regular season game ever viewed in the regular season, and that mindset, that opportunity that we believe we have, the football brings people together. That's even true on these big holidays that happen throughout the year. End quote. Is there any day that's going to be sacred, or are we just going to be playing, football 365 days a year pretty soon?
Well, the demand for football in this country is so high, and it's only going up. It's not going down. College football, here's another point of frustration I have with realignment in college sports, and you know, it's driven primarily by football and television and such. College football didn't need to change. It wasn't having problems. Okay, so baseball implemented a bunch of new rules over the last couple of years. The pitch clock, the runner on second, to make it a better television product, something that's easier to consume when you go to the ballpark and everything like that. Why? Because the television ratings were not very good. They were going down. College football and the NFL just have to exist. We are just a football craze culture. I'm here for it. I host a podcast 5 days a week in which I talk only about college football, and another one where I talk mostly about college football with the Ducks. So I'm here for the football craze culture that is the United States, because I think it is great. It's a fantastic sport. The scarcity of it makes it so appealing, and it's such a great game and exciting, and there's so many fantastic elements to it. And I don't see how, when there's more money to be made, when there's more money to be made around football, that decision gets made every time. Every time. Expand the college football playoff, expand the NFL regular season, expand the NFL playoffs, you know, play on Christmas Day, play on a Wednesday, whenever. Like, if the opportunity is there, it's going to happen. That's just the, in many ways, unfortunate reality. And, you know, the NBA used to own Christmas Day, and, well, move over, Adam Silver, the wrecking train of Roger Goodell's coming through.
I just don't like the fact that, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas, like, I get it, we're all together, we're going to have it in the background, but I'm not actually watching the game very intently. Like, I even have to go back and watch the game if I want to actually focus on what's happening in the game, because I'm, you know, hanging out with family and watching my kids. I'm making sure they're not, you know, causing problems with their cousins. Like, I'm not actually watching the game. Where if a game's just on a Sunday, like, I can sit down, I can watch the game. Or a Saturday, I can watch the game. When it's on a holiday, man, I can't focus on the game. I want to watch the game.
Well, I get that. I think the easy counter argument is,
just don't watch your kids.
When your family's driving you nuts, it's more fun to sit down and watch the game. Just sit down and watch. I mean, I think it can be, you know, an easy conversation driver for families that don't see each other very often. I think it's, you know, you've got families that are fans of a particular team that if their team's playing, that's, you know, the reason maybe that everybody is there. I think sports and holidays are a really, really good mix. I just think that, you know, the NBA used to own Christmas Day, and the NFL is just, they're a freight train. They're a freight train coming down the tracks, and you can't stop them, even if you wanted to.
Number five.
I don't know if you had this on your bingo card, Spencer, but Chris Farley and Jim Harbaugh have a little bit of things in common. It's been revealed that Jim Harbaugh has been living in an RV. Now, not quite by the river, van by the river, but he's been living in an RV the last 2 months since his return to the NFL. Harbaugh's been living in the RV in the Los Angeles area, neighboring his new offensive coordinator, Greg Roman. Harbaugh said, it's been great. I've always wanted to do that, live in an RV. It worked out great. I'm 100 feet from Greg Roman, who has a really, really good RV. Harbaugh says he's not fancy. He's just, you know, a Ford motor coach. Hits him just right. It's been really good. He goes back there. It's just great. Now, of course, early in the offseason, back in March, when he was with Michigan and went to the Chargers, Harbaugh had a garage sale at Ann Arbor, which caused a little bit of a stir as the family prepares to move with him to Southern California. They have not quite done that yet. So in the meantime, Harbaugh living in an RV in LA, I want to say down by a river, but that's a guess.
I did not know that this was you know, Harbaugh's a quirky guy.
He's fascinating.
He's an oddball, and this is a perfect example. Why on earth would someone who's got, how much money has he made from Michigan? He had been there since 2015. He'd been with the 49ers and Stanford before that. He's well compensated. This guy has got all the money he could possibly need.
He signed
for himself and his grandkids.
5-year, $80 million contract to go to the Chargers.
I guess the first paycheck hasn't hit yet. Do we need to look into Jim Harbaugh and the money he's been spending on gambling, and that's why he's living in the RV? Now it's time for the tinfoil hat on my head right there. I'm sure that theory will get going on Twitter any minute now. But no, I love that Harbaugh is Justin Herbert's coach. I mean, the Chargers organization finally realized, hey, if you want to win, you got to have the right coach. We're seeing this in the NCAA tournament. You know, I had down to talk about at some point today that, you know, in the tournament, who's succeeding is the best coaches. Kelvin Sampson at Houston. Go look at that guy's track record. He wins a lot of college basketball games. Who went on a run? Dana Altman. Who won his first round game in an 8-9 matchup in a down year? Tom Izzo, Mr. Marsh. Hubert Davis at North Carolina. I think John Shire at Duke is very good. Dan Hurley at UConn. Bobby Hurley's at Arizona State. Dan Hurley just won the national championship. He's in the Sweet 16. Matt Painter at Purdue hasn't always had the most success. Like, if you want to have a successful organization, you can't just have the players. You can't just have the, you got to have the right coach. And in the NFL, coaching mismatches are on display all the time. And for no team has that been more true than the Chargers over the last couple of years. Anthony Lynn and Brandon Staley aren't even coordinators right now in the NFL. That's who's been their head coach over the last couple of years. So Harbaugh is a weird guy. He's living in an RV, but you know what? As long as he's coaching Justin Herbert and company, you can do whatever you want. Whatever makes you happy.
How successful do you think the Chargers are going to be this year? Are they a Super Bowl contender type team, or is it going to take a year or two to get that roster going? Because they did have to make some cuts. They had to trade away Keenan Allen. They cut Mike Williams. They had to get under the cap. They're in a lot of cap trouble. But is this a team you're looking at to maybe play on and say, you know what, this is a team that can contend in the tough AFC West? You know, you got the Chargers. You got the Broncos. Yeah. You got the Chiefs. You got the Raiders who are up and coming. Like, is this a Chargers team that can compete for the playoffs?
The playoffs, yes. The Super Bowl, not yet. That'll take a year or two, but Harbaugh will get it going. And I think for the Chargers, you should make the playoffs this year. Like, coach, quarterback, you should make the playoffs. Roster, you know, they've made moves, but still, you've got a high draft pick. If they don't take Rome Odunze, barring Marvin Harrison Jr. being there, I'm unsure as to what they are thinking, because you got rid of Allen and Williams. Like, well, those were your top two targets. And Quentin Johnston has this small issue as a wide receiver where he can't catch the ball very well. So I think Odunze is a no-brainer pick for Justin Herbert there and the Chargers at five. I don't know if they move in that direction, but I think Harbaugh will need a year or two to get, you know, not just better players, but guys that he wants, better players who fit what he's going to try to do. But certainly, if you got Jim Harbaugh and Justin Herbert and the roster they do have, you should be in the playoffs.
Do you have any questions about Justin Herbert? He's only had one playoff appearance in 4 years. It's not a make or break year, but the fact that he's been not as good in the fourth quarter, you look at his interception numbers, like, way higher in the fourth quarter than they are in the first three quarters. Only the one playoff game, and it was a massive, you know, choke job. You can say Herbert, you can say Staley, you can say all of it, but is any of this land on Herbert? Is this one of those things where if Herbert can't succeed in year one, are we questioning Justin Herbert going into the next season?
I don't think there are a lot of questions about Justin Herbert. I think that the criticisms of him are what separate him from the Joe Burrows, Josh Allens, Patrick Mahomes of the world, not whether or not he, you know, can be a franchise guy. Like, he got a contract from the Chargers. You know who doesn't have a contract yet? Tua. You know why? Because they've got real questions, real concerns, real doubts, real problems potentially there at the quarterback position. Chargers didn't have an issue paying Justin Herbert real money for a reason. The issue was they weren't willing to pay a coach. And now they have, and I think that's going to pay dividends.
So you're not buying into the whole rumors of J.J. McCarthy of the Chargers now with Jim Harbaugh talking them up?
I think that is Harbaugh playing seven-dimensional chess in the NFL draft is all that is.
Very well could be. As he said, you know what, if quarterbacks could take in the top four picks, I have the first pick in the draft. I can look to trade that, do whatever. So yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a big year for Herbert. I have questions about Herbert still. Just, you know, the fact that he hasn't won a lot of games in the NFL when it matters the most. But talent-wise, you can't really argue that. He's awesome.
Wins are partially but not entirely a quarterback stat is where I think we'll leave it now. That's the 5-5. So, Gonzaga, boy, the Zags did it again. I got fooled by the Zags. I'll tell you why I was so very wrong. Coming up next with, I guess, talk about the Zags as well. Who knows a thing or two? That's the next up right here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
Hey, it's John Canzano.
You you've got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. College hoop season, best time of year. March Madness, greatest sporting event on planet Earth. It's usually a pretty good time to be a Zags fan on both men's and women's side because they, you may have heard this once or twice before, they're pretty good at doing that basketball, as Chance the Rapper in an SNL skit would perhaps describe it. Let's bring on our next guest, Julian Minnensohn, sports anchor up at KXLY-TV in Spokane. Julian, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, like they say in radio, let's do that radio, huh?
That's exactly right. Let's do that radio, Julian. So I got fooled. I'm a Santa Clara graduate, and I was down on the Zags this year, and I've got the text to prove that I thought they would beat Gonzaga at the Levy Center, as they did. And if you can lose to Santa Clara, who hasn't played in the tournament since Steve Nash was in college, which, yes, was a long time ago, I didn't think the Zags were going to continue their streak of making what is now their ninth consecutive Sweet 16 appearance. And, you know, on the other side of the break, I was talking about great coaches thriving in March. Mark Few was one of those guys. Death Taxes and Mark Few. How did he do it with this team that lost 2 of 3 to St. Mary's and, you know, had some not so great moments this year?
It's been absolutely unbelievable. I mean, he's even gone on record this year in saying that the talent discrepancy that they usually have isn't there. You know, there's a lack of depth on this team. They've had some major injuries to start the year and had to have a bunch of guys who are either freshmen or coming back and not a lot of experience playing college basketball Division I have to come in and all of a sudden be Gonzaga like we all know Gonzaga to be. And, you know, they were dead in the water pretty much in the middle of December, late December, but somehow, some way, they kind of rattled off, you know, 9 out of their last 10 to end the regular season into that WCC championship, which they lost. And then they've looked like a completely different team, particularly in the NCAA tournament. I mean, I expected maybe a win over Kansas, only because Kansas was banged up, but not 21 points better. This team has just found a way to come together. They know what they're good at. They're kind of an inside-out team, starting with EK and Anton Watson and Clackamas native Ben Gregg. Those guys have really come together, and they just – Mark just knows what to do during this time. It's one of those interesting things that, like you mentioned, Death Taxes and Mark Few. He just knows how to get his teams ready during this time of year, and so far it's been no different. I thought at the beginning of the year, given the talent that they had and you know, with Timmy leaving and Strother gone and the turnover there, that this had to be his best coaching job maybe of his career, and so far he's proven that to be true.
Yeah, they've made the second weekend. I'll just come out and say it. I picked them to lose to McNeese in the first round, and 8 minutes into that game realized that I was an idiot for picking against Mark Few in that particular spot. You know, I did think that they would have a chance to get by an injured Kansas team. I think that Kansas team at full strength is a Final Four caliber, but without Kevin McCullough Jr. and Dickinson being not at full strength, it was just a little bit tough. But you know, the Zags have been just a steady, consistent presence in the Sweet 16. Not everybody can say that. I mean, you look at a lot of great teams, programs, and coaches that haven't made the Sweet 16 as consistently as Gonzaga has. It's one of the longest streaks, I believe, in the history of the tournament. And Mark Few's been just such a staple of, you know, not just the WCC, but college basketball as a whole. Are fans just looking at him right now saying, wow, you lost 2 of 3 to St. Mary's and the Gales get bounced in the first round and Few goes to the Sweet 16 again? Are fans just looking at Few right now and once again shaking their heads while smiling and saying, man, we're lucky to have this guy?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that wasn't the tone earlier in the year. I think you would think if you live here in Spokane, you would think the sky is falling and that this is over with and the game has passed him by. But out of a lot of the old guard coaches, he kind of remains. And you know, it's funny with the level of consistency that he's had over the past 2+ decades. This program was kind of built on that Cinderella, who are they, nobody believes in them kind of role. And then that's obviously changed with the success over the last couple of years of the 25 straight NCAA tournaments, and like you mentioned, the 9 straight Sweet 16s. But this team, more than any other team that he's had, at least of recent memory, because they're not a number one seed or a 2 seed, because people pick against them, and because they've had some bad losses, they're kind of adopting that no one believes in a Cinderella mentality. And it's hard-pressed to call them, Gonzaga, a Cinderella these days, but that's what the fire that's kind of fueling them that, oh, you know, a month or two ago, this team wasn't even projected to make the NCAA tournament. And now, you know, a lot of people might put them even past Purdue in this game and giving them a legitimate shot to make a Final Four run here. It's just, it's interesting how the tide switches, because a team that was in the position that they were in about this mid-December, no other coach maybe other than Mark Few would get them to where the point is now.
Julian Mendenzone, sports anchor up at KXLY-TV in Spokane, joining me here on The Bald-Faced Truth. Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano. I think that what Few has done is, you know, kind of similar to what Dana Altman did with Oregon, and the Ducks really should be in the Sweet 16 right now. They had a 4-point lead with the ball, less than a minute to go against Creighton. They weren't able to finish the job, unfortunately, but it's been a remarkable coaching job, and yet in this modern world of coaching, Julian, you just can't ever stop thinking about tomorrow. Word came down just within the last 20, 30 minutes. I got a text from a friend that said Michael Ajayi is transferring from Pepperdine to Gonzaga for next year. 17.10 rebound per game guy with the Waves this season. I think he's crazy efficient as well. Your reaction to that news?
Yeah, I saw that, and it's incredible considering you're probably going to lose, well, you are going to lose Anton Watson, who's kind of your senior leader on the team and one of the scorers of this team. But it's even more incredible given the day and age of NIL, in which Gonzaga is kind of a step behind because they are a smaller school. They you know, they're not getting the top-tier freshman recruits that they may be usually getting, aside from maybe Dusty Stromer this past season. And so you wonder how a team like that in today's age of college athletics is going to continue that sustained level of success that we're used to seeing. And he did a really nice job this year, and of course now with the Ajayi news, of getting guys who are maybe under the radar in smaller conferences. You look at Graham Ike, he came from Wyoming. Steele Venters, who was injured this year but was set to be a big piece for this team, came from Eastern Washington. Now with Ajayi coming there, you've got a bona fide scorer that's known to play in the conference, and he replaces something that you're going to lose this year in a big body that could score, rebound, and kind of fit right into a starting lineup. Earlier this year, when things weren't going so well, you look at the roster, you say, oh, they're going to lose Watson, but they're going to bring back pretty much the same team. This is not good because they're not getting any recruits. And now with the success, and then you add Ajayi in the mix, you're looking at potentially another top 10 Gonzaga team that's going to be right there in the mix at the top of the year when it comes to the AP poll and all those big-time matchups. It's pretty incredible.
It's just hard to count them out. And, you know, the reason that I felt that this wasn't the year for Gonzaga to get to the second weekend at least and, you know, maybe get bounced in the first round was it's not the most talented team, and the results haven't consistently been there. And, you know, I also picked against the Gales in the first round. I proved to be right on that, having seen Grand Canyon firsthand in my play-by-play gig. But I just think it is a remarkable coaching job by Mark Few. And I think anyone that questions the Zags or Few and their ability to compete at a high level in college basketball is just being foolish and just looking for a reason to be upset or hate, as the kids say. But what are your thoughts on something else? Pat Chun, the athletic director at Washington State, takes the same job at Washington today. Your reaction?
Yeah, that came as a surprise to many. Now, I wasn't going to be surprised if Pat left, given, you know, the state of everything and where WSU kind of sits at the table amongst the big boys in college athletics. But to go to your rival school, and not just a rival, but a rival that also left you in the dust. And during the collapse of the Pac-12, one of the schools that didn't want anything to do with you or didn't want to take it with you or to any of these big conferences and any of that stuff like that. So that, and not just that, it's the timing of it all. There's no right way to leave, right? But it's tough considering your basketball coach just left yesterday. And now you're going to be searching for a new athletic director, and that's hindering the search for the basketball coach. And not only that, Pat Chun was set to be part of the college football playoff committee this coming year, and the idea was to have a voice in the room for the little guy, and that's not going to be a case anymore either, now that he's going to UW. I know a lot of, at least a lot of the fan sites that write for about the Cougars and a lot of the fan bases kind of, you know, betrayal and hurt is kind of the sentiment there. And it's going to be interesting because WCU has to move quickly because there's a lot of holes in their athletic department that they have to fix. But yeah, another kind of blow, to the stomach, if you're a gut punch, if you will, to the WSU, athletic department and their fan base with him leaving and to a rival that, you know, the block is hot when it comes to those two, the Cougars and the Huskies right now.
Yeah. I think for the Coug fans out there, you got a feel for them and you don't have a heart in the college sports space. Cause it's just not right. What's happening here. And I think you know, first day where it all felt real is when Oregon and Washington announced they were going to the Big Ten, and you know, then everyone else followed suit to go to the Big 12, the four corner schools, and then Cal and Stanford a few days later, oh, they're going to the ACC and such. But I think this is kind of another, you know, marker of, oh, this is real. This is happening. We're being relegated here, which I don't think is right personally, but that's just the way that it's coming to fruition. I think this is, you know, this is the consequence of it, unfortunately, for Washington State. I want to get you out of here on this, Julian, and that's the Lady Zags are also in the Sweet 16. They'll be playing in Portland. You can catch all the NCAA tournament action you want here on 750 The Game. But I think that, you know, the Gonzaga basketball programs have just been both so successful, and the Lady Zags taking on Texas. What kind of chance do you give them in that one?
Well, I'll tell you this. They're going to have a good travel section with them and following them only about a five-hour drive from Spokane to Portland. So, you know, this Gonzaga women's team has been pretty unbelievable. I mean, program record and wins. You know, they're also exciting to watch. They not only win, but win in style. You know, they've basically almost swept, like, every conference award. They have, you know, Lisa Fortier's done a great job there over the last few years, and they have a bunch of seniors who could have left after last year, but decided to come back, and this is for that very reason, to potentially make a deep run into March. You know, first Sweet 16 since 2015, they are going to probably have the bigger cheering section, I would imagine, being so close in proximity to Portland. I give them as good a shot as any. I think out of the 16 teams that are left in the women's side of things, if you kind of look at the brackets, if there was one of the top seeds to go down, this one probably would be it, at least to have somebody different other than maybe a one or two seed get to that Final Four. So I think it all sets up for Gonzaga to at least make it competitive. And they've proven they could do that by beating teams like Stanford earlier this year. So, yeah, I give them as good a shot as anybody. Like you said, not only in the men's side, but the women's side, you can't count out the Zags because there's a lot of pride when it comes to basketball, and they're going to, if they get knocked out, they're going to be make you pay for it. You're going to be bumped and bruised along the way.
Julian Minnesone, KXLY-TV in Spokane. Thanks so much for stopping by. Great talking to you.
Of course. Anytime, you guys. Thank you.
There he goes, as John always says here on the show. But we will be going to a break momentarily. Come back. And is Purdue Virginia? Well, history might be on their side. That's coming up next right here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
I challenge you to a dance-off.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Wrapping things up today, Spencer McLaughlin with you in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth. Matt Painter, we'll get to him in just a moment, is the head coach of Purdue men's basketball. And I don't want to alarm any of you who are still tracking your bracket pools and thinking who might emerge as the national champion this year in college basketball, but I've got a stat for you. I've got a stat. Here we go. 100% of the teams who have lost to a 16 seed have come back to win the national championship the following year. That's the stat. That's it. I could present that to you in the most misleading way possible, or I could tell you, as I am, how I'm misleading you, because I at least try to be honest. So the only other time one seed lost to a 16 was back in the 2017-18 year, and this team called the Virginia Cavaliers fell to the Golden Retrievers, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, of course, now legend in the sport. They came back the following year and won the national championship. Purdue is attempting to do the same. And I did not trust Purdue, who I've referred to before in my career as a sportscaster as Purdon't, because they don't tend to succeed in the biggest moments. I did not trust Purdue, thought they would lose in the second round to Utah State. My bracket stinks is the important thing here. But one of the reasons that I don't believe in Purdue is they are led and they run everything through a big guy. And their guard and perimeter play has got its moments, but it's all about the big guy. And the problem with that is somebody of that nature who doesn't, you know, handle the ball is relying on others to get him the ball. And I think that can be a downfall. That's why back to the basket centers have been phased out in the NBA, because they're not very efficient compared to those who can shoot, or just big guys who are, you know, more a part of the offense in a way that's, you know, cleaning up on the offensive glass and not having as many back to the basket touches, being able to shoot a little bit. But, you know, Matt Painter, the head coach of Purdue, is of course defending his center, which is what you would certainly want to hear if you're a fan of the Boilermakers. Here's what he had to say who think to those who think that Zach Edey, who is 7'3", I think, in that sort of range, is just tall. Here's Matt Painter.
Yeah, they just shouldn't cover basketball. Yeah, you know. And so, like, you go to school and you learn things or whatever, but we all don't like every single class we're in, right? It's kind of a necessary evil. It's like going to work. Like, you don't like everybody you work with, or you don't like certain parts of your job, and, you know, it's tough, right? You got to be able to deal with, like, certain things that are difficult. And so I just think everybody should, like, take tests on their knowledge of what they're doing. Like, I think all coaches should take a test so they understand refereeing, and I think all referees should take a test so they understand coaching, and I think all journalists should have to take a basketball quiz or a test, or anybody that tweets, they should have to be able to do it. And if they say something so moronic as that, then they should have to have a probationary status where they can't tweet for like 3 months. I think it'll help like society, you know, like just try to knock out the fools, you know, so they don't have to, you know, meet at the local Walmart and say things that don't make any sense.
A couple things. First of all, I'm always here for unfiltered, let it rip coach talk, because there's a lot of coach speak out there. I've talked with a lot of college sports coaches, basketball, football, whatever, and, you know, there's plenty of coach speak out there, and I understand it. There's, you know, an important aspect to coach speak when you're running a program and, you know, informing your fans and the media and your opponents of certain things and keeping certain things private and whatnot. But when a coach just kind of unleashes like that, I'm always here for it. Secondly, you talked in there about, you know, having to work with people and you don't always like it. And I can relate to that. I'm working with Steven and Judah here, and it's just an absolute nightmare. Absolutely brutal. But the final point that I want to raise on these comments from Matt Painter is, what a nice guy to just go out there and try to help the world. Isn't he just the nicest of guys, Steven, to go out there and say, you know, I think we could better society if everyone gets tested. That said, I was not tested, at least not directly, before I was allowed to come in and host this program today.
Good thing we weren't on TV. I would have got us kicked off right there by what you said about me. But here's the thing. I worked for the Blazers for a little bit, and I had to take a test to, like, prove I knew what I was doing for basketball. So, like, from that point of view, I kind of get what Matt Painter's saying. Like, maybe we should have a test for, like, journalists and people that cover the game, but I've also had some really bad takes that I've put out on Twitter that would definitely have suspended me if Matt Painter was the judge and jury of, you know, Twitter accounts. Like, I once, I thought Adam Morrison was going to be a really good professional basketball player. Like, that, I wanted the Blazers to draft him over LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, that was a thing that I'd said. I've said that numerous times. I thought Armon Johnson, backup point guard for the Blazers,
Hold on. Let's back up a moment. Just for all of you out there that are wanting to get into the sports talk space. Let Steven be proof positive that you shouldn't be afraid to be wrong, because I don't know if there is a more wrong take other than taking Oden over Durant than taking Adam Morrison over LaMarcus Aldridge. And Steven is still thriving. And contrary to the sarcastic remark I made earlier, he's quite good at his job.
I admit that I'm wrong. Like, I should have, I deserve to be suspended for 3 months. Painter would have suspended me. Like, well, Spencer, do you have a take? Judah, do you have a take of like what you would have been suspended for a bad take like that?
Oh gosh, my worst take ever. I mean, I thought the Pac-12 would survive. That didn't age very well.
I thought Russell Wilson was going to be a Seahawk for life. There is that. I also, I wanted Tyrus Thomas for LaMarcus.
Oh, Tyrus Thomas. So,
going back to that, wasn't that same draft?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, because he was traded for LaMarcus by the Bulls.
I loved Tyrus Thomas out of LSU.
Tyrus Thomas was electric.
Yeah.
So, Tyrus Thomas was electric. I'm also thinking of... Didn't the Blazers once upon a time have, what was the guy from Kansas? Robinson?
Yeah, Thomas Robinson.
Yeah, Thomas Robinson. Yeah, that guy was electric when he was, you know, on the floor. I thought Thomas Robinson would be very good. Worst takes ever. There are so many. It's hard to pick just one.
I had a lot of bet. Like, you could just go look at my bet slips and like, oh, that's a take. Like, I bet on Minnesota -35.5 against Bowling Green. They lost outright. Like, that. I've had those type of bets before. Like,
I need to find the people who were on USC -32.5 against Jim Harbaugh's Stanford at the Coliseum.
Right, exactly.
Back in the day. Like, the largest statistical upset in college football.
That is suspension worthy. Like, I should have been suspended a few different times, but here I am. I'm thriving right now, and I'm not suspended currently.
In this day and age, investigation worthy. How the hell is a 32-point favorite losing? Let's investigate that. Whose interpreter was on USC that day?
Yeah, I agree, Judah. I mean, the stars align right there. Somebody at USC was clearly making cheddar. This is all very sarcastic, just so we can be utterly clear with our words here. But... We'll just kind of wrap on this for today, guys. I picked Houston to win before the tournament started. If I had to, you know, reassess my pick, I might go to UConn, but I still think Houston has got something about them. Those guys play real defense. They remind me of Baylor from a couple of years ago that beat Gonzaga in the national championship game.
I got UConn. I got Houston actually losing to Duke in this next round. We'll see what happens. I really like Arizona. I'm excited to see an Arizona versus UConn Final Four. That's what I really want to see.
That would be fun. By the way, Duke hasn't beaten a higher-seeded team in the NCAA tournament since, like, 1997. That's the exact number there. So, Houston, UConn, hard to not like them. I think North Carolina's really good. Hubert Davis, very good coach, but... It's the best time of year. You can catch all the tournament action here on 750 The Game, Sweet 16, starting later this week. For Steven and Judah, I'm Spencer McLaughlin in for John Canzano. Been a pleasure as always. Guys, thanks for having me back. I will see you next time. And until then, hope you have a most wonderful rest of your day.
Guys, for those of